Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is to sift through a stack of sources detailing one of the most intense, consequential 24-hour periods in recent federal history.
It really was something.
We are undertaking an exhaustive, granular report on every significant action across the U.S. federal government from the beginning of September 23, 2025. This is the Federal News Update for Wednesday, September 24th, 2025. I'm your host, Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. And Alex, exhaustion is definitely the right word. What we saw on September 23rd wasn't just, you know, a busy news day.
No.
It felt like a profound, highly kinetic assertion of unilateral executive power, really challenging international alliances, domestic regulatory norms, even the fundamental structure of the administrative state itself.
The contrast is just so stark, isn't it? You have this incredibly aggressive, sweeping action from the executive branch and also the judicial branch getting heavily involved.
Right.
And then on the other side, the legislative branch, Congress, the House and Senate, completely dormant. I mean, zero legislative floor activity, zero committee activity recorded.
It's a striking image. It paints a picture of a policy landscape utterly dominated by the executive on that day. You really have to see this day as a kind of strategic pivot point.
How so?
We're watching the administration actively trying to dismantle established frameworks. And they use this day, September 23rd, to send some very clear signals, both globally and right here at home.
Okay, so let's unpack this monumental day. I guess we have to start where the president himself started on the world stage with that really forceful address at the United Nations General Assembly.
Yeah, the UNGA speech.
That UN address, it was anything but your standard diplomatic boilerplate, was it? Felt very rooted in that America First doctrine, lots of emphasis on transactional relationships and a really searing critique of the whole multilateral system. What were the core themes there? What was the goal of using such aggressive rhetoric?
Well, the central goal seemed to be validating the president's domestic agenda by sort of projecting it onto the world stage.
Mm-hmm.
He framed the U.S. approach as the superior model, naturally, mm-hmm. and then issued these sharp, direct warnings to European allies about what he called the double-tailed monster.
That phrase definitely caught everyone's attention immediately. The two tails being migration and green energy. How did he specifically connect those two things?
He tied them together with this explicit warning of essentially national failure. On the green energy scams, as he put it, the president stated very clearly that sticking to those policies will cause European countries to fail.
Just flat out fail.
Flat out. And then he coupled that with even stronger language on migration, telling allies, and this is a direct quote, if you don't stop people that you've never seen before, that you have nothing in common with, your country is going to fail.
Mm.
So this isn't just, you know, a policy disagreement. It looks like an attempt to fracture Western unity, portraying collective global action, whether it's on climate or humanitarian issues, as basically an existential threat to national sovereignty.
And these critiques, they were immediately backed up by one of the most, frankly, astonishing policy reversals of the year, mm-hmm. the shift on the Russia-Ukraine war.
Yeah, that was huge.
For months, the administration's stance had suggested, you know, maybe limited U.S. interest in the outcome, leaning towards some kind of negotiated settlement, maybe involving territorial compromise.
Right. That seemed to be the direction. But that position just vanished after the president met with Ukrainian President Zelensky.
So what's the new position?
The new dramatic reversal is that the president now apparently believes Ukraine, with continued NATO and EU support, can and should fight and win all of Ukraine back in its original form.
Original form. So pre-2014 borders.
That seems to be the implication. It's a complete 180-degree turn back towards the goal of total territorial integrity for Kyiv. It fundamentally realigns U.S. diplomatic and presumably military objectives.
And the language around this shift was incredibly provocative towards Moscow, calling Russia a paper tiger. Was that just political bravado, or is there maybe some new intelligence assessment behind that?
It feels largely like political bravado. You know, framing it that way minimizes the perceived cost and duration of the war while maximizing the appearance of strength in this new aggressive policy.
Mm-hmm.
But crucially, this new position was immediately backed by a concrete economic threat. The administration is prepared to hit Moscow with a very strong round of powerful tariffs if President Putin refuses to enter negotiations aimed at achieving that full Ukrainian victory.
So using economic muscle.
Exactly. Yeah. It signals this new policy isn't just about helping Kyiv. It's about leveraging U.S. economic power to try and impose a very specific endgame on the conflict.
The UN address wasn't only about Ukraine, though. At the same time, the administration moved to, well, structurally and financially hobble the United Nations itself, reinforcing that whole America first posture.
This is where we see the really aggressive financial actions kick in. The U.S. has already clawed back $1 billion in previously allocated contributions.
A billion. Just pulled it back.
Pulled it back. And formally signaled the intent to cut another $1 billion. Now, considering the U.S. is the single largest donor to the U.N., this is basically an act of institutional sabotage. It creates immediate fiscal instability for the organization.
And the consequences aren't just theoretical budget numbers, are they? We're looking at a projected U.N. budget shortfall, what, $500 million in 2026 alone. What are the specific human consequences of this kind of withdrawal?
The impact is felt immediately and directly in the humanitarian sphere. The UN projects that these forced operational cuts translate to about a 20% job cut across its humanitarian and peacekeeping agencies.
20%?
20%. We're talking about tangible loss of life support. The World Food Program is warning that something like 16.7 million vulnerable people could lose food assistance.
16.7 million.
And the UNHCR, the refugee agency, projects that 11 million displaced people, refugees, migrants, internally displaced folks could lose vital aid, shelter, protection, basic necessities.
That is just a staggering scale of human impact. But you mentioned there's a deeper sort of strategic consequence, too, related to human rights monitoring.
Yes. Diplomats are warning that this U.S. financial withdrawal creates a vacuum. And that vacuum immediately empowers authoritarian governments, China, Russia, others, to lobby harder for cuts to human rights investigations.
Why? What's the connection?
These funds support crucial oversight in conflict zones, in politically sensitive areas. For example, there's immense concern this pressure will halt ongoing human rights investigations in places like the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Right.
And significantly reduce global monitoring of things like political torture. Mm. So the goal of this financial clawback seems twofold. One, save money, obviously. But two, actively diminish the UN's capacity to hold regimes accountable for human rights abuses.
This transactional approach to foreign policy was also pretty evident in the days of bilateral diplomacy and the use of sanctions, right?
Exactly. On the alliance front, you saw the president cementing ideological ties. He met with and offered a full endorsement and help to Argentine President Javier Milei, who's facing a crucial election.
So shoring up a fellow populist leader.
Precisely.
Yeah.
A clear move to bolster someone seen as an ideological ally, especially one facing significant domestic economic challenges.
And then there was the use of sanctions as, well, a political weapon, specifically targeting Brazil. This feels like a real escalation in what was already a pretty tense relationship.
It's a very aggressive escalation, targeting the judiciary of a historically close ally, the Treasury Department, through OFAC, sanctioned Viviane Barsi de Moraes.
And who is she?
She's the wife of Brazilian Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes. And Justice de Moraes happens to be leading a very high-profile investigation into the president's ally, former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro.
So sanctioning the spouse of a foreign judge who's investigating your political ally, what message does that send?
It sends a deliberate and highly visible message attempting to exert pressure on foreign legal systems investigating political friends of the administration. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent claimed the action targeted individuals who provide material support to de Moraes as he abuses human rights.
Strong language.
Very strong. And this follows other punitive actions against Brazil. They had already revoked visas for de Moraes and other justices and slapped a major 50% tariff on the country back in July.
Right.
It makes it crystal clear the U.S. is willing to weaponize economic tools to intervene directly in the judicial processes of sovereign nations if it serves to protect its ideological partners.
Okay, let's pivot dramatically now from foreign policy back to domestic security.
Yeah.
Because the executive branch was equally aggressive on that front. We're looking at an astonishing array of unilateral actions aimed at restructuring domestic security and immigration enforcement.
Yeah, the domestic front was just as active.
We absolutely have to start with the Antifa designation. This followed the tragic assassination of the far-right activist Charlie Kirk. The president signed an executive order on September 22nd designating Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization, and it directed agencies to investigate, disrupt, and dismantle its operations.
This is a highly significant move, and legally a very fraught one. While it sends a powerful political signal, you know, to the base, it immediately runs into constitutional friction. Because the U.S. actually lacks a statutory mechanism to officially label a purely domestic group as a terrorist organization. That legal framework, it's reserved for foreign terrorist organizations, FTOs.
And we know FBI Director Christopher Wray has previously described Antifa not as a cohesive group, but more as an ideology or a movement. So if the formal designation is largely symbolic, what's the practical impact? What does it mean for activists?
That's the crucial point. The designation itself might be legally symbolic, but it provides powerful political cover for intensified surveillance and prosecution under existing laws.
Like the Patriot Act.
Notably, the Patriot Act. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It lowers the political threshold for agencies to investigate left-wing activists.
Mm.
It allows them potentially to use existing statutes, things dealing with conspiracy, property damage, maybe material support, in a way that could generate a significant chilling effect on political dissent and association. It effectively moves the goalposts for what constitutes legitimate protest.
Okay, moving from political targets to the economy and immigration, the administration announced a major overhaul of the high-skilled immigration system. This included that big H-1B visa restriction and the creation of something called the Gold Card. Let's start with the H-1B proclamation.
Right. The new rule, which took effect September 21st, imposes what is essentially a prohibitive fee, $100,000 per petition for H-1B workers.
$100,000 per worker.
Per petition. Unless the employer can secure a national interest exemption, which one assumes won't be easy to get, This is a massive jump from the previous fee range, which was typically somewhere between, say, $2,000 and $5,000.
Huge difference.
Huge. And Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick was explicit about the goal, framing this as a measure to compel big tech to hire American workers onshore by removing the economic advantage of hiring foreign talent.
That logic, I mean, it makes a certain kind of surface level sense, but critics are already arguing that this $100,000 fee is just, you know, a new tax on innovation that will actually accelerate high-skilled jobs leaving the U.S.
Mm.
What's the counterargument to that offshoring critique?
Well, the administration's counterargument is that the previous system allowed companies to exploit a wage arbitrage. H-1B workers, on average, often earn significantly less, maybe 40% less, than comparable native IT managers.
Okay.
So a $100,000 fee completely eliminates that arbitrage. Gone. But the concern, as you said, is that it makes it more economically rational for U.S. companies to simply expand their existing offshore operations, places like India, Singapore, other innovation hubs.
Rather than pay the premium here.
Exactly. Rather than pay the new premium to hire onshore. India's commerce minister has already reacted quite sharply, warning about humanitarian consequences and suggesting the U.S. is afraid of our talent. So the net effect could very well be a slowdown in U.S. innovation and actually a boost for foreign competitors.
And this action on skilled labor is happening at the same time as the creation of the Gold Card executive order, which seems structurally contradictory.
It really highlights the administration's specific economic calculus, doesn't it? Tax immigrant labor heavily, but sell immediate access to immigrant wealth.
How does the Gold Card work?
The executive order creates a program to expedite immigrant visas for foreign nationals who make a substantial financial gift. That's the term used in the Department of Commerce.
A gift.
A gift. It essentially establishes a fast-track, buy-in pathway for high-net-worth individuals, running completely parallel to the aggressive crackdown on labor-based visas and, of course, low-skilled immigration. The message seems pretty clear. The administration values capital far, far more than labor.
Which brings us to the core enforcement mechanisms. DHS announced a major milestone. Over 2 million illegal aliens, their term, removed or self-deported since the start of the administration in January 2025.
That figure is genuinely staggering for less than, 250 days? It breaks down into an estimated 1.6 million self-deportations.
Meaning people just leaving on their own?
Exactly. People leaving the country likely due to the increasingly hostile enforcement climate, the difficulty finding work, the fear of detention, and then over 400,000 formal deportations carried out by ICE.
And DHS is spinning this as a success.
They're using this data to validate the strategy, yes. They're citing a UN study, interestingly, using the UN when convenient, that claims a 97% reduction in migrants heading northbound from Central America, presenting that as evidence of a powerful deterrent effect.
But that deterrence, it comes at a significant cost, doesn't it? Particularly in the domestic detention system.
Absolutely. The enforcement push has required this massive and, frankly, punitive expansion of the detention system. We're now seeing nearly 60,000 people held in ICE detention on any given day. That's a record high.
60,000.
60,000.
Mm-hmm.
And over 70% of those individuals have no criminal convictions whatsoever. They're mostly asylum seekers or people picked up for immigration violations.
And conditions inside.
Even more troubling is the spike in punitive practices within the system. The use of solitary confinement, for example, particularly for vulnerable people, those with serious mental or physical health conditions, has spiked by a shocking 56% since fiscal year 2022.
56% increase in solitary.
Yes. The strategy appears to be using both formal deportations and systemic cruelty, harsh conditions, isolation, to create a climate that compels mass self-deportation.
Okay, shifting from the border to homeland security threats, we also saw a major national security story involving the Secret Service, a pre-UNGA takedown of a massive telecom threat near New York City.
This was apparently a colossal threat. Agent Matt McCool, who was quoted, believes it could become one of the largest post-9/11 national security investigations.
What exactly did they find?
The Secret Service dismantled this network of over 300 SIM servers, just packed with more than 100,000 SIM cards, all operating within a 35-mile radius of the United Nations headquarters during the General Assembly. The estimated street value of the seized equipment alone is over $3 million.
Okay, for listeners who aren't familiar, why are these SIM server clusters, these SIM farms, so dangerous? And why the comparison to a cellular blackout after 9/11? That sounds incredibly alarming.
Right. These clusters function as highly sophisticated, massive-scale illegal switching operations. They pose really three critical threats. First, they can overwhelm local cellular networks, and they're used to mask encrypted communications. Think organized crime, cartels, maybe even state actors using them for illicit purposes. Second, because of the sheer density of simultaneous network requests these things can generate, investigators believe they have the capability to actually black out cellular service in significant parts of New York City at a time of their choosing.
Just shut down cell service.
Potentially, yes. A scenario that, as Agent McCool noted, eerily mirrors the network collapse and communications paralysis that happened after the 9/11 attacks and also after the Boston Marathon bombing. A major disruption capability.
And the third threat?
Third, an actual forensic analysis is apparently pointing towards state actors using these networks to communicate with organized crime groups, which suggests a kind of fusion of national security threats and transnational criminality.
Wow. Okay. In related news, within the Department of Homeland Security itself, CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, got a new leader for infrastructure security, Steve Casapula.
That's right. Casapula was appointed Executive Assistant Director for Infrastructure Security. Now, this appointment comes at a somewhat tricky political moment. While CISA obviously needs strong leadership, the agency's really critical National Risk Management Center. This is the part that analyzes the interdependencies between critical sectors like energy, finance, telecom, is actually slated for significant staffing cuts.
Cuts, while appointing a new leader.
Exactly. $70 million and 35 positions are planned for elimination under the FY 2026 budget request. The justification given was eliminating initiative planning and coordination efforts. So you see the appointment of a leader, but at the same time, the proposed dismantling of a key analytical capacity within the same agency.
The pace here is just relentless. Okay, let's move on. We need to dig into the profound policy implementations and regulatory rollbacks that were announced across various departments on this single day.
Yes, the departments were incredibly busy implementing the administration's agenda.
We have to start with the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS. The president announced bold new actions to confront what he termed the autism epidemic. This put HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and the FDA on some highly controversial scientific ground.
Yes. The most immediately disruptive action here was the FDA initiating the process to change the labeling for acetaminophen.
Acetaminophen. That's Tylenol, right?
Yeah.
The common pain reliever.
Exactly. Tylenol and many other generic versions. The proposed new label would suggest it may cause autism and ADHD in children whose mothers took it while pregnant. This is a massive public health announcement, and it generated immediate, significant scientific backlash.
Tell us about that backlash. Who's pushing back and why?
Pretty much global and domestic health authorities are explicitly refuting the idea of a causal link. The World Health Organization, the European Union, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, ACOG, they've all stated publicly that while some epidemiological studies have noted a possible correlation.
Correlation, not causation.
Precisely. Correlation is not causation. There is no established causal link. The primary concern among physicians, including Republicans like Senator Bill Cassidy, who's a doctor,
right,
is that this kind of advisory, without a sound scientific basis, forces pregnant women to avoid necessary pain management, which could lead to its own set of complications during pregnancy.
And the president himself amplified this anxiety by actually advising pregnant women to just tough it out instead of taking the pain reliever.
Yes, that rhetoric caused immediate confusion and alarm among medical professionals and parents-to-be. Even the FDA's own commissioner, Marty McGarry, had to publicly walk it back a bit, noting that while an association had been described, a causal relationship had definitely not been established. It really felt like prioritizing an ideological signal over established medical consensus.
And this is compounded by concerns raised by some GOP senators about political pressure being applied to the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP.
That's right. Secretary Kennedy had already overhauled ACIP. He fired all 17 previous members and replaced them with individuals generally perceived as more sympathetic to his views on vaccines.
Right, that was controversial at the time.
Very. The concern now, voiced by senators, is that he's pressuring this new committee to approve changes to childhood vaccine recommendations. Specifically mentioned was the hepatitis B vaccine for newborns, regardless of the existing scientific data supporting it. As one senator bluntly asked, "You're going to change a medical guideline without science?" It really speaks to the administration's willingness to use the mechanisms of public health agencies to promote specific ideological viewpoints.
Despite all that controversy, HHS did announce some more, let's say, standard funding initiatives on the same day.
Yes, amidst the storm, there was some traditional activity. $61.9 million in supplemental funding was announced for the Make America Healthy Again, MAHA initiative. That's going across 290 Head Start programs, focusing on nutrition, farm-to-table partnerships, improving kitchen facilities.
Okay.
And SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, also awarded $45 million in grants for sober housing services, specifically targeting young adults.
Oh.
So some standard grant making continued.
Okay, now let's look at the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, which seems to be working to dismantle the entire legal foundation of climate regulation in the U.S.
This is arguably the single most audacious regulatory rollback announced that day. The EPA's core proposal is to repeal the foundational 2009 endangerment finding for greenhouse gases.
Remind us why that finding is so important.
That finding, which was established based on the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Clean Air Act in Massachusetts v. EPA, is the indispensable scientific and legal cornerstone for all federal greenhouse gas regulation. If you repeal it, you effectively halt federal climate regulation in the U.S. almost overnight.
And the EPA's rationale for doing this, they're claiming the Clean Air Act doesn't authorize regulating greenhouse gases for climate change, and they're relying on some highly controversial analysis.
Correct. The legal argument about the Clean Air Act itself is one part, but the key scientific controversy is their reliance on a Department of Energy report authored by known climate science skeptics.
And what does that report argue?
It argues that rising CO2 emissions will result in beneficial global greening, explicitly rejecting decades of scientific consensus on climate risks and harms. The argument is essentially, the harms are imaginary or exaggerated, but the benefits of more CO2 are real.
Let's focus on the economic clash here
Yeah.
because the numbers being thrown around are just stunning. The EPA claims this repeal would save up to $444 billion annually. How on earth do they arrive at that figure?
This is the crucial policy maneuver we need to unpack. They get to that $444 billion in savings by eliminating regulatory costs, yes. But they do it by using an analysis that effectively values the harm caused by climate change at zero.
Zero.
Zero. Prior administrations used a metric called the social cost of carbon, the SEC, to quantify the economic benefits of avoiding future warming things like avoided storm damage, health costs, agricultural losses. That was projected at around $150 billion annually in benefits from regulation. By completely excluding the SEC, by valuing the public health and environmental consequences of climate change at $0, the EPA can claim these monumental savings without having to account for the costs of inaction. Critics project that if this repeal goes through, it could allow up to 18 billion additional tons of climate pollution into the atmosphere by 2055. It's basically an accounting trick designed to justify a predetermined deregulatory outcome.
And on a smaller scale, but still significant for transparency, the EPA is also proposing to eliminate the greenhouse gas reporting program.
Yes, that program is a vital public resource. It mandates reporting on climate pollution from major industrial sources across the country, power plants, factories, refineries. Eliminating it would greatly reduce public and regulatory visibility into who is polluting what and where. It makes tracking industrial climate impacts much, much harder.
Okay, switching gears completely now to law enforcement. The Department of Justice, DOJ, announced a record-setting nationwide fraud takedown.
Yes. This was billed as the largest healthcare fraud takedown in U.S. history. 324 defendants charged in connection with over $14.6 billion in alleged fraud schemes, things like fraudulent billing, kickbacks, telemedicine scams.
$14.6 billion, that's enormous. Was the enforcement action significant too?
It appears so. The government seized over $245 million in assets, cash, luxury vehicles, real estate, cryptocurrency, a significant haul.
And this action also signaled a focus on modernizing how they fight fraud, correct?
It did. The DOJ announced the creation of a new healthcare fraud data fusion center. The idea is to specifically leverage artificial intelligence and improve interagency data sharing to detect these increasingly complex fraud schemes much earlier.
Using AI.
Using AI. And they also announced the expansion of the New England Strike Force, which is one of their key regional healthcare fraud units, into Massachusetts. So it shows a focus on both regional enforcement expansion and technological modernization.
Okay. Over at the Treasury Department, we saw a significant move toward modernizing how the IRS interacts with taxpayers.
Yes. The IRS is beginning the phase out of paper tax refund checks, starting with individual taxpayers. This is actually a huge administrative and security gain.
Why is that?
Paper checks are notoriously inefficient. They're apparently 16 times more likely to be lost or stolen than electronic payments. And maintaining the system for paper checks cost taxpayers over $657 million in 2024 alone.
Oh, wow, that much.
Yeah. So for the 7% of recipients who still get paper checks, the IRS will provide new electronic options, including prepaid debit cards and digital wallets like PayPal or Venmo. Treasury also continued its sanctions work separately, targeting some notorious Costa Rican narco traffickers through OFAC.
Let's quickly cover some notable organizational shifts happening at the Department of Defense, DOD.
Sure. U.S. Central Command, CETCOM, announced the formation of a new task force, the Rapid Employment Joint Task Force, or REJTF. It's being led by their Chief Technology Officer, Joy Schanenberger.
And its purpose?
The goal is to aggressively streamline the process of getting innovative technology, things like new drones, AI systems, counter-drone tech, fielded to warfighters much faster. The target is 60 days or less from identification to deployment. It's all about cutting through bureaucracy to maintain a technological edge in the field.
Okay, but in stark contrast to that kind of modernization effort, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is actually shuttering a very old advisory panel.
Yes, he announced the termination of the Defense Advisory Committee on Women in the Services, DACWITS. This panel was established way back in 1951.
74 years old. Why shut it down now?
The secretary explicitly accused the panel of advancing a divisive feminist agenda that hurts combat readiness. This action seems clearly part of the administration's broader push to eliminate advisory groups that are perceived as focusing on diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives.
Got it. Anything else from DOD?
Just one more minor item. The DOD also issued guidance lifting civilian travel limitations and restoring credit limits on government travel charge cards. Suggests a return towards pre-pandemic travel norms for civilian personnel.
All right. And finally, in this whirlwind tour of departments, the Department of Transportation, DOT, announced a RIARD allocation for Hurricane Helene relief in North Carolina.
That's right. Transportation Secretary Sean P. Duffy announced $1.15 billion in emergency relief funding for the North Carolina Department of Transportation, NCDOT. This is specifically for repairs related to the devastation from Hurricane Helene. Numerically, it is the largest single allocation ever from the Federal Highway Administration ER program.
But the context here is crucial, isn't it? What does $1.15 billion actually cover when you look at the total damage estimate?
It really highlights the massive recovery gap that states face after these mega disasters. The storm caused an estimated $59.6 billion in total damages across North Carolina.
$59.6 billion.
Billion with a B. So while $1.15 billion is a record allocation from that specific FHWA program, it covers only about 9% of the state's estimated total damages. North Carolina is still lobbying Congress for an additional $13.5 billion in new appropriations just to cover more immediate needs. It underscores that even record federal relief often leaves states with an overwhelming fiscal deficit after a truly catastrophic event.
It's just clear the executive branch was operating at an incredible tempo. But we absolutely must now transition to what might be the single most structurally important set of developments from September 23rd, the actions in the judicial branch, specifically the Supreme Court, and the resulting constitutional fault lines that opened up.
Yes, the judicial actions were arguably the most fundamentally significant of the day.
The Supreme Court really set the stage for a constitutional showdown of potentially historic proportions. It all centers on the case of the fired Federal Trade Commissioner Rebecca Slaughter.
The court delivered two massive blows to the established structure of the administrative state on this single day. First, it granted a stay, which effectively allowed the president's firing of Commissioner Slaughter to proceed while the case continues.
Yeah, okay.
Second, and this is the fundamentally more consequential part, the court granted certiorari, meaning it agreed to hear the case on its merits, specifically to re-examine the 90-year-old precedent of Humphrey's executor of the United States.
Now, Humphrey's executor, that sounds like pretty dense legal history, but the potential impact is immediate and radical, isn't it? Explain why overturning this specific precedent would fundamentally reshape American governance.
Right. It sounds obscure, but it's foundational. Before 1935, presidents generally had the power to fire most executive branch officers pretty much at will. But in Humphrey's executor, a unanimous Supreme Court decision established that Congress could create independent agencies. Think of the Federal Reserve, the SEC, the NLRB, the FCC, and insulate their leaders from at-will presidential removal.
How are they insulated?
These leaders could only be removed for specific stated causes laid out in the statute, like inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. Not just because the president disagreed with their policies or wanted his own person in the job.
So, if this precedent, Humphrey's executor, is overturned, the independent agencies that were designed to stabilize our economy and our regulatory environment, they would instantly fall under purely political control.
That is precisely the danger. The president would potentially gain the power to fire the chair of the Federal Reserve because he disagreed with interest rate policy, or fire the entire Securities and Exchange Commission because he disliked a particular enforcement action against a company or individual.
It would erase the structural independence.
Exactly. It would eliminate the structural independence that's supposed to separate core regulatory functions from short-term political pressure. It would fundamentally transform the administrative state into essentially a direct extension of the president's personal will and policy preferences.
Justice Elena Kagan wrote a dissent arguing the majority was using the emergency docket, the so-called shadow docket, to reshape the nation's separation of powers. That language really reflects the gravity of the signal being sent here.
It absolutely does. And the arguments presented reflect this view, too. The Solicitor General, D. John Sauer, argued that the president suffers irreparable harm when executive power is transferred to officers beyond his direct control. That perfectly encapsulates the administration's view. Independent agency leaders must serve at the pleasure of the executive. The stakes for the stability of the economy and the neutrality of federal regulation just couldn't be higher.
Now, moving beyond the Supreme Court's potential future actions, we also have granular evidence emerging that the administrative state is already suffering from functional impairment. Mm. A recent legal opinion from Judge William Alsup questioned whether federal courts should even continue channeling federal employee disputes to agencies that appear to be functionally impaired.
Yes, that opinion really highlighted how the internal federal watchdog and HR mechanisms seem to be either paralyzed or, in some cases, actively repurposed. Judge Alsup specifically pointed to three key agencies facing critical issues. Think of these as the internal dispute resolution system for the entire 2 million-plus federal workforce.
Okay, first, the Merit Systems Protection Board, the MSPB. What's its role and what's its current status according to this opinion?
The MSPB is basically the final court of appeal for federal employees who are facing termination, demotion, suspension, or other serious adverse personnel actions. It's supposed to ensure due process. Judge Alsup noted bluntly that the MSPB has essentially stopped doing any work at all.
Stopped doing any work.
Completely non-functional due to lack of Senate-confirmed board members for extended periods. This means thousands of federal employee appeals are just stuck in limbo, effectively eroding the due process rights of the civil service.
Okay, second agency, the Federal Labor Relations Authority, the FLRA. This mediates disputes between federal agencies and employee unions, right?
That's right. The FLRA also has serious quorum problems following the firing of its former chairwoman, Susan Sui Grunman. While they technically might still have a quorum of two members, if those two members disagree on a case, they're deadlocked.
So nothing gets decided.
Exactly. As Judge Alsup colorfully put it, in that situation, two is no better than one or none. The result is near paralysis. He cited figures showing that in July 2024, the FLRA decided 6 matters. In July 2025, they decided just 1. The referee for crucial federal labor disputes is effectively broken down.
And finally, the Office of Special Counsel, the OSC. This is the agency that handles whistleblowing claims and investigates prohibited personnel practices. It seems to have done a complete 180 on its mission.
According to Judge Alsup's assessment, yes. The OSC is where federal workers are supposed to go when they believe their agency has violated the law,
right,
particularly regarding hiring, firing, or retaliation against whistleblowers. Following the firing of the previous special counsel, Hampton Dellinger, Judge Alsup noted the replacement special counsel has repudiated the office's former view that mass terminations, especially of probationary workers without due process, were contrary to law.
So the watchdog is siding with management.
Essentially, Alsup argues, the current OSC has started working for the other side, validating mass agency firings rather than protecting the federal employees who report waste, fraud, and abuse. This pattern across these key agencies, paralysis at MSPB, deadlock at FLRA, political capture at OSC, is crippling the internal stability and accountability mechanisms of the federal government itself.
This administrative upheaval leads us directly to the final major structural shift we saw on September 23rd, the apparent militarization of the immigration courts.
Yes. The Department of Justice announced a decision to send up to 600 military lawyers, JAG-AG officers, into immigration courts. The stated goal is to try and ease the massive record backlog of 3.5 million pending cases.
600 lawyers, that sounds like a significant boost in manpower.
It effectively doubles the immigration judge workforce, yes. But the controversy lies in the fact that these military personnel generally lack real experience in the complexities of U.S. immigration law. The qualification requirements were apparently lowered specifically to allow the assignment of lawyers whose primary backgrounds are in military disciplinary tribunals or administrative law, not asylum law or removal defense.
So this shift suggests the process itself is fundamentally changing, moving away from a quasi-judicial hearing towards something more like a disciplinary proceeding. What are the implications for asylum seekers?
The implications for due process, particularly for asylum seekers, are potentially severe. In 2024, asylum claims were approved at about a 42% rate in the traditional civilian immigration courts run by the Executive Office for Immigration Review, EOIR.
Okay, 42%.
However, in specialized military jurisdictions, like those sometimes established near the border for rapid processing, that approval rate historically drops dramatically, typically, to no more than 10 to 15%.
Wow, huge difference.
Huge. This strategic pivot seems to favor speed and enforcement outcomes over complex legal analysis and individualized assessment of fear or persecution claims. The result is what critics are calling a militarization of the system, turning immigration proceedings into something closer to expedited removal processes with profound human consequences. We're seeing this tested particularly in places like Texas and Florida.
We've covered just an astonishing day of executive and judicial kinetic action. Now we have to turn to the final piece of this puzzle, the legislative branch, Congress, which provides such a shocking contrast to all of this activity.
Yeah, the silence from Capitol Hill was deafening that day.
As we've noted throughout, Congress was entirely dormant on September 23rd. Zero floor activity, zero committee activity in either the House or the Senate. This complete ceding of the policymaking landscape to the executive is highly relevant, isn't it, considering the rapidly approaching September 30th government shutdown deadline?
Absolutely. The political maneuvering around the shutdown has moved into high gear. We saw the president cancel a planned meeting with Democratic congressional leaders, publicly citing their, quote, unserious and ridiculous demands. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries fired back, accusing the president of actively wanting a shutdown to avoid dealing with difficult issues, particularly health care funding.
The dynamics of this potential shutdown feel very different from past standoffs, though. Why do Republicans seem to feel they hold the advantage this time around?
It's a different calculation. In past shutdowns, Republicans often took the political hit because Democrats successfully framed the GOP as irresponsibly shutting down popular government services.
Right, that was the usual playbook.
This time, the GOP seems to feel empowered by the president's demonstrated willingness to use his immense discretionary executive power to define what services are essential and which are not during a lapse in appropriations. The strategy appears highly political. Use that power to selectively shutter major visible parts of the government, for example, leaving phones unmanned at HHS, the VA, maybe the IRS taxpayer service lines, particularly in ways that impact Democratic constituencies or blue states more heavily.
And then blame Democrats for the fallout.
and then blame Democrats for the fallout if a funding deal isn't reached on Republican terms. It's a game of political brinkmanship, where the party perceived as valuing the functioning of government more any corrector. Typically, the Democrats might be structurally at a messaging disadvantage against an executive willing to weaponize the disruption itself.
We also can't forget that the Affordable Care Act subsidies are a massive component tangled up in this negotiation calculus, right?
They are probably the central non-appropriations demand hanging over everything. The enhanced tax credits that help millions of Americans afford ACA health insurance plans are currently slated to expire at the end of the year.
Which would mean huge premium increases.
Exactly. Significant sticker shock and potentially unaffordable price increases for millions just before an election year. Extending these subsidies is a non-negotiable key demand for Democrats, so it's become a critical bargaining chip in the overall appropriations package negotiation needed to avoid a partial government closure at the end of the month.
Sam, as we wrap up this exhaustive report on just a single day's activity, September 23rd, 2025, let's try to synthesize this whirlwind. What were the three overarching trends that really defined this remarkable day?
Okay, three big takeaways. First, unquestionably, is the muscular use of presidential power. This day was just defined by unilateral action, the dramatic Ukraine policy pivot, the prohibitive H-1B fee, the sweeping regulatory rollbacks at the EPA, all largely bypassing an inactive legislative process and concentrating immense power in the executive branch.
Okay, number one, muscular executive power. What's second?
Second, we saw a profound challenge to norms and precedents. This includes everything from the president's direct, harsh critique of European allies' internal politics to the outright rejection of established climate consensus with the EPA's global greening rationale.
Right.
The controversial public health pronouncements coming out of HHS that bucked scientific consensus, and perhaps most fundamentally, the Supreme Court's clear signal that it is willing to reconsider and potentially overturn the 90-year-old precedent of Humphrey's executor governing independent agencies. The administration is actively working to dismantle long-established structures of governance.
Challenging norms and precedents. And the third trend.
And finally, the third trend that was really evident is the heavy use of policy as ideological signaling. The Antifa designation, for instance, despite its legal ambiguities, serves as a very clear political message aimed squarely at the administration's base.
Mm.
Likewise, the controversial HHS Autism Initiative seems to prioritize engaging specific ideological narratives over adhering strictly to established scientific consensus. Governance, on this day at least, appeared to be driven as much, if not more, by political narrative and base engagement than by conventional policy development goals.
What an absolutely astonishing 24 hours to dissect. We've covered everything from dramatic shifts in international affairs and moves that could dismantle the UN's human rights functions,
yeah,
to a $100,000 fee for H-1B visas, a record $14.6 billion Justice Department fraud takedown, and the looming threat of direct political control over independent institutions like the Federal Reserve.
It truly was a day that demonstrates just how swiftly and fundamentally executive and judicial action can redefine the nation's policy landscape, and even its governing structure, often while Congress is effectively watching from the sidelines.
Which brings us to a final provocative thought for you, our listener, to perhaps mull over after this deep dive. We've detailed today how key administrative agencies designed to handle internal federal disputes, the MSPB for employee appeals, the FLRA for labor relations, the OSC for whistleblowers appear to be either paralyzed or politically repurposed.
Functionally impaired, as Judge Alsop put it.
Functionally impaired. If the internal HR and watchdog mechanisms for the entire federal government are compromised, and simultaneously the Supreme Court is signaling its willingness to potentially strip the heads of critical independent regulatory bodies like the Federal Reserve or the SEC of their insulation from political firing, what then is the ultimate recourse? For federal employees seeking due process, and maybe more broadly, for maintaining the stability and predictability of the rules governing the American economy itself.
That fundamental tension between administrative paralysis on one hand and highly centralized political control on the other is really the central constitutional question emerging in our time. And the events of September 23rd certainly brought us much closer to seeing how it might play out.
Thank you for joining us for the deep dive. We will absolutely continue tracking these developments as they unfold.